Welcome to the Great Bays Tennis Podcast. I'm Steve Smith. We're fortunate today to have Stuart Van Horn, son of the legendary Welby Van Horn, one of our pillars. Stuart, welcome.
I appreciate it. Thanks for the invite. Glad to be here.
It's great to have you here. A few things about your father. So many Arthur Ashe quotes. You could tell a Welby Van Horn student from a mile away. Another one was, if you're going to start a student from scratch, there is best place to go would be Welby Van Horn. And so unusual that a former world-class player taught beginners. And then the results he had teaching basically just the children of the members of the, you know, the facility, four courts in San Juan, Puerto Rico. Charlie Passarella, his formula, of the word formula, Welby's formula is timeless. Fundamentals stand the test of time. I'll just go with one more quote. Alex Mayer, both his children are in the top 10 in the world, Sandy and Gene. And Alex Mayer said, paraphrasing, I consider myself to be one of the best five tennis coaches in the world. And then there's Welby Van Horn, and nobody cares. Nobody compares to him. But why don't we work backwards and let's talk, why don't you talk a little bit about his pro career?
Yeah, sure. So my dad was, he was born in California and he grew up playing California junior tennis and national tennis. And, he actually was the, U.S. boys doubles champion along with, I believe his name was David Freeman. I remember the last name Freeman, first name might've been David. But that got him noticed on the national scene. And he only actually played 3 years of, in the amateur circuit. So back during that time, 1938, 1939, 1940, he was in his late teens. And he was good enough to get a spot in the first year in 1938 to get into the U.S. National Championships, which is now, of course, the U.S. Open, you know, after the Open started in 68. But the U.S. National Championship in that year, he got in and he lost in the first round. I don't remember who it was to, but it was a great experience. And the following year, 1939, he actually made it all the way to the finals, and he lost to Bobby Riggs in the finals. The next year, he played again, and he lost in either the first or second round. So he actually only had three amateur championship appearances before World War II broke out. And when the war broke out, a lot of the tennis players that were playing at that time, Bobby Riggs, Jack Kramer, you know, the other notables.
Yeah, Don Budge.
Well, the ones are a little bit more closer to my dad's age. Don Budge was a little bit older.
Okay.
Ellsworth Fiennes was a little bit older. Bill Tilden was much older. But they were all of war age. So they were all being drafted into the military. And many of them, like Bobby Riggs and Jack Kramer, they actually got drafted and they went into the military and served during World War II in that capacity. And there was a little bit of limited amateur tennis. The ones that were in the military were mostly going on tours, playing around different bases. But my dad had asthma and he had it really bad. It was an affliction that started when he was fairly young, probably 11, 12. And so he couldn't go into the service. He was not qualified to go in. So he had to work during the war. And at that point, that's when he decided that he turned pro. And at that time, when you turn pro, you're excluded from being able to play in the U.S. championships and Wimbledon at that time. So he went on his pro career, and from, I believe he turned pro in 1942, and he played on the pro tour until 1951. And back then, most of the way that the professional circuit was set up was a lot of states had open championships. So the pros that were still playing during the war years, and then when the other players came back after the war was over, if they were still in the declared amateur status, you know, they could still play in the pro championships, just not take any money, or so they say. And so my dad played in that pro circuit, and you know, his contemporaries were Jack Kramer, Bobby Riggs, Frank Kovacs, Jimmy Everett, Chris Everett's father, during that time was also playing. So that was more of the high point, the mid-career. And then towards the latter part of my dad's professional career playing tennis, Pancho Gonzalez and Pancho Segura started coming onto the scene. So he started competing against them. But, you know, he actually did pretty well in those back then, the pro championships that the pros played in. There were three of them, but the war interrupted all of them. And as those started to come back online, 1945, my father played in the U.S. Pro Tennis Championships, and he won it that year. And he was runner-up in multiple years through either quarters, semifinals, or in the finals as a runner-up, all the way up through 1950, I think. And he won the doubles in that tournament a couple times. He played in the late 50s in the goes by two names. One is the Wembley Pro Championships, or they call it the British Professional Championships. He got to the finals in that, singles and doubles a couple of times, and he paired up many times with Bobby Riggs and Jack Kramer and Frank Kovacs playing those tournaments. So he had a really good career, being, he was probably top five between, you know, off and on between 1942 and 1951. The highest he had was a top five professional tennis ranking. But of course, you know, again, those folks that had come back from the war, like Jack Kramer and Bobby Riggs, they still were in an amateur status. So they continued playing in that status and going on to play the U.S. National Championships and Wimbledon and, you know, doing very well in that arena. I was probably 2007, my dad and I had gone down to Chris Everett's tennis down in Boca Raton. And I don't know Chris, but I know her brother, Drew. So we made an arrangement for my dad to sit down and catch up with Jimmy Everett.
Oh, that's nice.
They could talk old times. And it was funny to see the two of them just recounting their professional tennis years during those times. And they were talking about the number of tournaments and doubles that they won. And my dad was actually a pretty good doubles player from the accounts that people give me. And it was funny because they teamed up to win the U.S. Pro Clay Court Doubles Championships that was held in St. Augustine. I believe that was in the late 40s. And one was arguing, oh, we only won that one time. And the other was arguing, no, we won that two times. So I didn't know what the truth is. And, you know, finally I found this book by Joe McCauley. It's called The History of Professional Tennis Players, or Tennis, Professional Tennis. And I looked in it and I found the record. It was actually twice. So it was Jimmy Everett that said they won it twice.
You have some draw sheets that you have from that book, or is that from the internet?
Yeah, this is from the internet, the draw sheets from different years. And, you know, the players that were playing back then, they're all the names that you all recognize. There's Fred Perry, Don Budge, Bill Tilden, Dick Skeen, some of the names that of people that were really good tennis players back then. Carl Earn, Bruce Barnes, John Nogrady, and of course Bobby Riggs, Jackie Kramer. You know, there was a really, really good bunch of tennis players that were playing during the war years and afterwards in these professional tennis tournaments. And so they're a little bit of maybe you could call them the unsung heroes of the early professional pathway to becoming what we have now, you know, after the open era in 1968. But, you know, these people that were playing in these tournaments back then in the U.S. Pro Tennis Championships and also in the Wembley or the British Professional or the French Professional, They were the best tennis players in the world at that time. The ones that were playing amateur, they were playing in these tournaments and losing to these players. You know, sometimes they beat them, sometimes they didn't. But the best tennis players in the world were playing in these professional tennis tournaments at that time. And you look in the ladder into the 50s and the 60s, you start seeing all the typical names that we all know, Rod Laver, Lou Hoad, Ken Rosewall. All those people played these tournaments at that time, likely without taking any money, so they could still play in the amateur championships. And then they all transitioned into being true professionals, you know, in the sense that they could take money openly and you know, make a living at it. So yeah, it's very interesting to see the type of history that's coming out on the internet and in books.
With Welby as a player, I mean, I remember asking him, he said, Welby, you absolutely never miss an overhead. And he said, well, Steve, when I was a kid, there was no TV. You just go out and he would self-feed. He would call it a self-drop. He'd say self-drop beforehand. He used a Dunlop Maxfly. And he was the youngest until Sampras in 1990 when in New York. Welby was the youngest finalist. But McEnroe, I can remember when McEnroe won in 79, it was using the same racket. I'm sure it was improved to some degree, but it was the same Dunlop Maxfly. With Welby's skill set, I know he played multiple sports, but he didn't really have lessons. He was self-taught. His father, so your grandfather passed away when he was like 13 or 14, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yes, he did. Yeah, he. I think my grandfather had a brain tumor, so... from the stories I hear from my grandmother when she was alive, my dad was pretty much on his own to go out and learn how to play tennis. And he was playing baseball a lot. He did have a connection to baseball early on. He had his mother had gotten remarried and not too long after my grandfather had passed away. And that side of the family had some association with baseball. My dad really enjoyed baseball. And actually some of his earlier balance concepts in his teaching method came from form that you see when throwers, pitchers are throwing the baseball. The whole balance and technique, he used that a lot in his teaching method to explain to people. Do you know how to throw a baseball? If you do, show me. And then you say, okay, well, it's pretty similar. So he really did enjoy baseball, and he actually, in 1939, after he reached the finals at the U.S. National Championships, he got an invitation to go try out with the Boston Red Sox. So I have a photo and some old news articles showing him in a Red Sox uniform. And he told me a story about that one time. He said that he was pitching against Ted Williams in that tryout, and they didn't offer him a spot to be on the team, but it was impressive enough that he did get the invitation. And so he continued on after that with his tennis career. But baseball has always been something that I remember in his teachings. And throughout our life growing up, he really enjoyed just with tennis camp counselors and other people. He'd love to go out and throw catch. He could do that for hours on end.
Yeah, that doesn't really happen anymore. I know I played baseball growing up, but I was never serious about baseball, but go to a picnic and your uncle would say, hey, you want to play catch? But there was outdoor entertainment. You know, there was more, you know, playing in your backyard, more, you know, it's called what, sandlot sports, pickup sports. With Welby's competitive game, I don't think it ever went away, even though he may not have picked up the racket, but I would have met him in 79. I met Joe Brandy and his younger brother Andy the year before, and I was just told they grew up and were taught by Welby and said that he's the best. And so that's when his camp was at Choate, and I remember Nandan Ball, you would know him, and
sure,
granted there was maybe 300 people watching, and but Nandan was very, very good player. He ended up later being the Davis Cup captain in India, and it was an exhibition, and they Nandan hits the first ball in the warm-up in the net. So the exhibition stopped for like 10, 12 minutes, and Welby gave a lecture like, how can you miss a ball in the net? But the game was so much placement because of the wooden racket. And Welby was, you'd have to tell me, 79. I think he might have been, you know, 61, 62 years old. He won that exhibition.
He was born in 1920.
Okay. Yeah, so we've been 59 years old. Do my math with, yeah, Kramer's is roughly the same age. And they were considered to be on the Davis Cup team, and they were beating teams, but they didn't allow that. They didn't choose him just because of their inexperience, I guess, when they were 18.
Yeah, my dad and Jack Kramer were actually very close friends in their teams. They competed and played against each other a lot. And they both were also on the U.S. Junior Davis Cup team. And then when it came around the year, I guess they must have been 18. I'm not sure if they were 19. I've got photos of both of them practicing, you know, from AP News, press, old photos, with the descriptions on them saying, you know, during the practice rounds before Davis Cup selection. So yeah, at that time they were both too young, and it wasn't really, because my dad ended up turning pro. He wasn't eligible to play in Davis Cup after that, but, Jack Kramer and some of the other contemporaries at that time who remained amateur, they were, of course, able to go on and play in Davis Cup after that. Yeah, so they remained lifelong friends. I've actually never personally met Jack Kramer. I've met Bobby Riggs a number of times, and Wayne Sabin and Carl Earn and Dick Skeen and another of those other individuals, but I never had the opportunity or the pleasure to meet Jack Kramer, but I would have liked to have.
Before I met your father, I was buddies with Wayne Sabin. I was in Boca Raton, and I call myself the perennial tennis bum.
That's where Wayne lived.
Yeah, and at this time, when I met him, I was living in a van. I used to hit balls with him. He used to knock on the van and go, "You guys are beating the rent." But it was really fun for me when I met Welby. Is Wayne Sabin had told me all about Welby's tennis game. Wayne Sabin could not swear. SOB. I mean, he would hit the approach shot, you know, hit the approach shot, and you would just, you know, turn around and say, "What's the score now?" But Wayne won the Wimbledon plate. He was really good. They don't have that anymore, but they used to have a consolation tournament for the first round losers. So many good things have gone away. I think the junior should know that back in the day, for no money, basically. I think the winner at one time, it was something like a $27 gift certificate. They just played for love of the game. Why don't you tell us a little bit about how your dad was paid in equipment?
So my dad used to tell me stories that if there wasn't very much money at a particular tournament when they're going around the country, a lot of these states would have an open, professional open tournament. And all the pros at that time were playing in those. And there wasn't very much money, like you said before. The winner might get $100. And maybe back then that could have been a lot of money, but it certainly wasn't enough to live on. And so equipment manufacturers, you know, back then the big ones were Spalding and what was the other one? Bancroft was around at that time. So they would actually get, my dad would tell me he would get 100 rackets after a tournament, and they would say, "Okay, here, we're gonna give you rackets, and we want you to help us advertise and spread the word about our equipment." So that was kind of how he would take his payment. And he'd go to other tournaments and he'd sell the rackets, and he had one of those portable, I can't imagine what they looked like back then. They must have been monstrosities to be able to put in a car to string a tennis racket. But he would get tennis strings and clothes from different manufacturers, and that's pretty much how they lived, and going from tournament to tournament. And then every now and then they would get a gig for teaching tennis at some club, and they'd stay there for a little while. And my dad taught at many different clubs across the United States. A few of them that I remember, he taught at the in Chattanooga, there's a famous one, Manker Patton Tennis Center, and he taught up in Rockaway and Rye, New York, and Westchester, and he was in Atlanta, and he taught in St. Augustine. He taught down in Boca Raton. So while they were switching back and forth between going from tournament to tournament, they'd spend a little time at a particular tennis location, And that's how they would make their money.
With Jack Kramer coming back to Jack Kramer, I was fortunate to just meet him. Never really, as you say, get to know Jack Kramer, but he would pop in occasionally to the Vic Braden Tennis College where I worked. And I remember the first time I actually taught a lesson at the tennis college. I was team teaching with Jack's oldest son. And then a couple of years later, I was asked to teach his youngest son. But what Kramer said about tennis teaching, you know, which is great, is that he goes, there's a big difference between playing and teaching. And he certainly said so many nice things about your father, what he did as a tennis teacher. But with Kramer, one time he came to watch Vic's students, watch him hit the ball. And, you know, they hit for like 5 minutes and he called him in and he said, I'll come back in a month. This isn't really worth my time because none of you can keep the ball in play. But the way that, you know, people talk to one another, I mean, this was probably even maybe a little bit before your time, but tennis players, I guess, from the U.S. take 22 days to go by boat to play Australia. So there was a lot of time just watching people play and figuring out how to beat this player and that player. And but one thing that Welby told me at one point with Kramer, you know, he ended up being, you know, so instrumental with the ATP and pro tennis. He was so charismatic. But Welby played him in a very important match when it went five sets. And if Welby had won that match, he would have been in on the, like the 100-day tours where they would just go from city to city. And there was more money in that. But it just, you think back, it was just so unfair because, you know, he was among the best players in the world. And but if you were just outside, like say the top four, I mean, it could have been like 100 matches between Kramer and Riggs, Kramer and Gonzalez, where they would go from city to city. And as you said, there weren't that many tournaments. You know, now the tournaments are week to week from city to city. But back then it was just and they would get a certain percentage of the gate. So it was significant money. And Welby was just on the outside of that. But Kramer got to the point, and that's how, you know, what Vic Braden did for Kramer is he managed the tour. You know, but it was just the listeners. I mean, they would have they had an old school bus that was stripped, and they would take the court with them. They would put the court down on a hockey rink or a basketball floor, and
that's amazing.
Yeah, with Welby's skill set, like here's a question off the wall: you must have played some ping pong or some putt putt with your father.
Oh, we played a lot, and he was. I think, as you know, my dad was very competitive. It didn't matter what he was playing. It was ping pong, putt-putt. If you're just out on the driving range doing target practice, or if he's playing backgammon, he loved to play checkers. He absolutely loved all kinds of card games, and he was extremely competitive.
What a mind, yeah.
Yeah, he exactly. He was very calculating and very competitive. And he just absolutely he loved the thrill of competing. And seeing someone else on the other side of him, one of his competitors, like sweat because they know they're not going to beat him.
Like what he did with golf.
Yeah, exactly. So ping pong and putt-putt, that's interesting because that one was really something more during the summer months when we had tennis camp. So during the years in Choate, they had a large recreation facility that had – almost had 6-7 ping pong tables in there. And pretty much every day after tennis, you know, all the kids and the counselors and my dad would be in there and they'd be having like these little round robin ping pong tournaments. And it's funny because he wouldn't attempt to beat people. His motto was always, you're not out there to beat someone. You're out there just to make sure you don't get beaten. So he would really frustrate, you know, the other counselors because he would just keep on. He wasn't hitting winners on the ping pong table. He would just keep on hitting. And then he'd start toying with them where he'd do like a full balance. You know, you can imagine that a ping pong hit or strike is something that nowadays you see as like very rapid movement. And he was doing it almost like with a full tennis swing. and getting it in on the other side all the time. He just absolutely loved to do that.
One thing with ping pong, I remember Welby, the rush to make it competitive. He found some poor kid who had the really thick Coke bottle glasses. Say, hey, kid, I'll wear your glasses. And he was playing with his opposite hand. I mean, just spotting people points. This is to make it competitive. I remember that he would, wherever he would be, he'd ask, you know, visiting friends or family or in some city, he wanted to know if they had putt-putt. And he would go there and stay there till he broke the record, and then he would leave, whatever the course record was.
Yeah, he absolutely loved putt-putt also. There were a number of places that I think in all three locations where the tennis camp was, he always found putt-putt. And it was always a big highlight to go out on the – it was usually towards the latter part of the week when tennis was winding down a little bit.
Yeah.
It was kind of ping pong after tennis every day, and then towards the latter part of the week doing putt-putt and over the weekend. And even tried to – at one time he was looking into doing a putt-putt course at the Hilton Hotel or somewhere in San Juan where he was living. But there wasn't much of an excitement or a desire for putt-putt down there. So that didn't exactly work out. But he always really cherished the summers because he really enjoyed doing that.
You know, one of his students who you and I know well, Manny Diaz, he was a guest on our podcast, coach at the University of Georgia. In fact, just yesterday, one of his students, a freshman, one of his players, won the NCAA men's title. So I said, you can't escape the answer. You have to tell me. You got to pick a name. And he had worked with John Isner and Michael Pernforce, and they both cracked the top 10 in the world. I said, those two and Welby, who wins? And he just said Welby because they were just so competitive. And then we also said on the podcast, if John Isner had Welby as a coach and he had his, say, for just one example, his backhand volley, what would have been the difference? Because he'd have millions and millions of more dollars in the bank. With Welby, along those lines, he used to meet people and just say, how do you develop a tennis mind? And he certainly, he was the money player, you know, where there's so many stories. It's actually in Ed Weiss's book, written on your dad, The Secrets of a True Tennis Master. There was a pro tournament that I believe Manny shared this story on the podcast. So Welby's older, he's teaching all these juniors, but Welby created a pro tournament. And the young kids wanted to go, Welby, could you play with these guys? He goes, yeah, I think I still play with these guys. And go, could we watch you play with one of these guys? And then the members got involved, the parents. And Welby said, well, we have to put something on it. You know, there has to be some money involved. And you know, he ended up playing the person who had won the tournament. I don't remember who it was at this point, but the world-class players were there. You know, who's who in tennis was there. And it was just one set. And all the members around, the juniors, and Welby played, and Welby won. With that Max Play racket, he used to play really young kids, and he would no strings in his racket and just hit the ball on the throw of the racket. Then he did, I guess, three cross strings or four, and then to the main and go out and play with that. It's just amazing.
Yeah, it's incredible hand-eye coordination, you know, and being able to play with so few strings like that. You know, it was always a big proponent of trying to hit the ball on the center of the strings. And it's like a point that he wanted to prove that if you could actually do that, you don't really need that many strings. You don't need all the strings around the tennis racket. You're only shooting for the ones in the middle.
Yeah, Welby would, somebody would hit the wooden racket and he would say, you're not playing my song.
Yes. Yeah.
With Marty Fish, I hear his name when they talk about ex-tennis players who are really good golfers. Wasn't Welby didn't he win the amateur title in Puerto Rico?
Yeah, he was actually a really good golfer. I don't think he took up golf until his 40s. So there used to be, I don't know if they do it anymore, but there was an Amateur of the Americas tournament. And all the really good amateurs from around the Caribbean and South America would come to Puerto Rico for this annual tournament. And he won that one time, and he was runner-up, and was a really good golfer. He was, his golf club that he played at, was a member at, was a Dorado Beach resort, which is one of the first places that I believe Nick Bollettieri, when he came to Puerto Rico, he started out at that resort. a great golf course facility, and he remained competitive in golf all the way up until his mid-80s. He was still playing golf down in Palm Springs when he moved out there.
No, I think Welby, with his combined careers, he should be in the International Tennis Hall of Fame. Nick Politeri, you know, rightfully so, he's in the Hall of Fame based on environment, the environment that he created. But for years, they were both on the same island. And at that time, Nick basically was doing resort tennis. He wasn't doing competitive junior tennis. I wrote a letter, and I don't do this very often, but it was published in the old defunct World Tennis Magazine. And Welby had said, Nick Politeri was in the previous month. There was an article, and Nick had said, "I don't understand the Welby Van Horn. I never understood the Welby Van Horn classical stuff." And then my letter was to the editor, was published, I believe, because I had worked for Welby, and I never was on Nick Politeri's payroll, but he had hired many people that I trained to teach tennis. So my opening sentence was, "Well, I'm just that. I worked for Welby, and I spent a lot of time dealing with Nick Politeri, even though I never worked for him. My students did." And I said, "We should just speculate what would have happened if Nick, the environment he created, and all those young players had the Welby Van Horn formula, this system." And I think Welby, one of the reasons of many that he was so successful, because he was such a good player. You're going to get kids' attention when you can play so well.
Right.
But also, too, he's very humble. I remember him saying that one thing that really helped him out is he taught, one of his first students was Charlie Passarell. So early on, he just had a student who was so good. Julie Anthony wrote this in her book, that Charlie Passarell wanted to quit tennis because he, was complaining to his mother that Welby was being too tough on him. And Joe Brandy overcame polio, and one leg was a little bit shorter than the other, and he was ranked like 33 in the U.S. in the 18s. And they're cousins. And Mrs. Passarell, Charlie's mother, said, "Hey, if your cousin can play on one leg, you can toughen up and go deal with Welby." With that, why don't you describe a little bit about, this was all done on four courts.
Yeah, it was a very small tennis facility. It was at the Caribe Hilton Hotel in San Juan. That hotel was built in the late 40s, I think. My dad got there. He arrived in 1951. And I'm not sure how many courts they had in the beginning, but basically through the 50s, the 60s, and into the probably mid-70s, there was just four tennis courts. Eventually, they added two more tennis courts, so there was six. But during the time that all those really good young players, of the club members like you described, they had four courts to play on, and there was a lot of competition for the court time between the guests, the hotel guests that were coming there. They also had a social membership of all the parents of these kids. They were wanting court time, and then you had to be able to find court time for the kids to go out and train. And one of the things that my dad was really big on is that he had two backboards built there, so that when there were times that the kids couldn't go out and train on the tennis courts, they had the backboards. And he would get up, like, you could get 10 kids on the backboards, and they could rotate. One would hit up against backboard, then someone else comes in, hits the next one, and so on and so forth. So he did a lot of different training techniques on those backboards to be able to get the kids stroke time so that they could develop their strokes, because you don't necessarily have to be on the tennis court all the time to be able to develop your stroke, your timing, your adjustment of your body to know where to be able to position yourself. You can get a lot out of a backboard in doing that. So it was a real balancing act. And it's absolutely amazing on those courts how many really good players came out of it. A lot of, during the 60s especially, Puerto Rico was producing more national champions in the 12s, 14s, 16s, 18s coming out of Puerto Rico than Florida and California were. And that was largely due to, you know, students that were my dad's students. And many of them went on to go play for, you know, all the major tennis powerhouse colleges at that time, Stanford, UCLA,
amazing,
USC. And, you know, a few of them went on afterwards to still be in the tennis industry. Like you mentioned, Manny Diaz, you know, the coach of Georgia, and he was there. He was a Bulldog player. He played on the Georgia tennis team, as many other players that grew up at the Hilton played also. Just the list is endless of how many Puerto Rican students went to Georgia. They were either directly tutored by my dad or maybe by one of my dad's students who ended up becoming a teacher also.
This scenario where I was told, okay, this is how it worked. You, before your half hour lesson with Welby, you would be on the backboard. And then after your half hour lesson, you would stand in front of the reflection of his pro shop window. And you know, if he's working with you on, say, an underspin backhand drive, you know, you just were under his watchful eye. But the other thing that was a big part of that environment is the hotel guests. They would come down and be looking for a game. And the story is that Welby would hook them up with a 9-year-old, and they would kind of go, they kind of roll their eyes, and they'd go lose to the 9-year-old. And they'd be there for a 7-day vacation, and they would come back, and they'd come back the next day, and they'd lose to another 9-year-old. That's actually how the tennis camp happened with the businessman of Phil Eisenberg. That he was there on vacation, and for some reason, Welby had to, you know, go to the hotel, take a phone call, meet with someone. It was an emergency, and. He just had a youngster. He goes, well, this young player, will 12 years old, help you with your game until I come back. I'll be back in 10 minutes. And Phil was just shocked at how well the 12-year-old taught him during that time. And that's where, you know, the tennis camp idea began.
Yeah, Phil Eisenberg and his wife, Betsy, they had a phenomenal relationship with my father. Three different locations spanning the early 70s through 1991, I think is the last year the camp occurred.
And Boca Hotel, was it Piner's in between?
Right. It was at the Choate Rosemary Hall Prep School in Wallingford, Connecticut through the 70s into the early 80s. And then the mid 80s was in the Pinehurst Hotel and Resort in Pinehurst, North Carolina. And then it went to Boca Raton Resort down in Boca Raton.
I was very fortunate, a set of circumstances. So I went to Choate to, you know, learn from Welby. And then my parents had retired in Southern Pines, right next to Pinehurst. So I would make a point to go visit my parents for a week. And then I would go over and hang out with Welby. And then I was running Academy Saguzzo Bassett in Boca Raton, which is now Chris Everett's. And that's when he was at the hotel. But during that time, I was fortunate to set up a program where you get a 2-year degree. And I was really dealing with Betsy, where she was hiring people from our program to teach in the summer. So initially, I just went for that one summer to work. But I was very fortunate to get to spend a lot of time around Welby. I'll tell you one story with Welby. When Borg had his run, you get the 6 Wimbledon finals in a row, 1-5 in a row. And one of Welby's students, who got to be 14, 15 in the world, big guy, Victor Maya, he had almost beat Borg. It went 5 sets. He almost knocked Borg out of the box, and Borg, his record would have been broken. I think it was the fourth Wimbledon. And so I just was fortunate enough to be able to just tag along and shadow Welby. I wasn't coaching on the staff. I would just go, and I made that my vacation to go hang out with Welby. Spend time with my parents in the evening and Welby during the day. And so this journalist from the New York Times comes down and he says, do you think Victor Maya has a chance this year? He goes with it. You know, they just went off, and he goes, well, with his serve, he always has a chance. It was on grass. But then he just went through a complete breakdown of Victor Maya's game. You know, I taught him to do this when he's a kid, and now what he's doing on the backhand volley, and just amazing. With, I think one thing, special experience was when he was in extended care towards the latter stages of his life. And I sat with him and watched a Federer match. He was so big on balance. He loved Federer.
Yes, yeah, he did. It was one of his favorite models. It was closest to his methodology.
And in his, you know, he lived to be, what, 94, so he's still tweaking his system. And I just remember saying, you know, I was wrong on the forehand side where, you know, he had the beginner's grip and then the championship grip, but it was circumstance because back then the grass was so bad. When it would rain like at Wimbledon, and three out of the four Grand Slams were on grass, there was no crew to pull out the tarp. Back in the day, the players didn't even have chairs to sit down in. If you look at the changeovers, they're standing. And then by the second week, especially in England where there's so much rain, the players are wearing spikes. So they just didn't want the ball to bounce. And you know, the composite of some people called the Australian on the forehand side, that much of a detail where the grip could go over, you know, on the grip turning eight sides, just 1/8, you know, that's what he's saying, that's what should have happened with this system. So he's always trying to improve it. And right. that's what winners do.
Right. Yeah. And that's actually when I was growing up and, you know, learning the game also, it's a lot of it was you hit a flat ball with that grip and then you hit an underspin ball on both the forehand and the backhand. And as you said, as he progressed through his thinking about what he called the range of correctness, his range of correctness might have been a narrow band of what he thought was appropriate, and you did not go beyond those. But his band expanded over time, and so you know, the range of correctness expanded. And he was always a proponent of making sure you learn the fundamentals, and I think that's from his early career, like you said, the types of playing surfaces that they played on had a large impact on his style that made its way into his teaching methodology. And then as court surfaces and equipment changed and people started hitting more two-handed backhands, you know, he was constantly reevaluating that range of correctness and what would be an acceptable and incorporating that into his teaching methodology. I don't think I started really hitting topspin with you know, semi-Western grip until I was probably into my teens and learning that. And that was mostly coincident with progression of playing surfaces and equipment and things like that. Because I also played for a very long time. I played with a Dunlop Max Fly. And there's a lot you could do with that racket back then. But as you're starting to play other people who are getting into, I guess it was in the late 70s, Prince came out with the large one
racket,
size
yeah.
wooden racket. And I started playing with that. And it was a little bit of a battle with my father as to whether or not there was better equipment that helped me play better tennis. So it was always a little bit of he moves a step forward, then maybe takes a half a step back, and then he moves a step forward. And it wasn't always a linear progression. It was constant reevaluation of where that range of correctness was.
For our listeners, I became very involved with Dennis Vandermeer, learning more about tennis teaching. In fact, when I was trained by Dennis the first time, I raised my hand. I don't think he really liked my question. I said, "Who else should we study under?" And he said, he only mentioned one person, who was your father. And he said, "Well, Van Horn," Dennis is such a character. He goes, "He's probably the worst resort coach in the world, but he's the best junior coach in the world." And he goes, "I don't know how he does it, but he gets a kid to take three lessons where they don't hit one ball." And, you know, with actually, Stuart brought this in today. It's old record with Welby Van Horn. In fact, our library, Andy Fisell, is part of our library in Germany, and he sent excerpts of this to us digitally, listened to it on the phone. And this just happened a few days ago where a student came here and did a complete assessment. We filmed their strokes and match play and went home, and then people that he's working with, could be a little incriminating if, okay, we did some video and this is how you hit a volley, this is how you hit a serve, because it's fact-based. And, you know, then the criticism was, well, you're teaching everybody the same. So during the interview on this recording, Welby goes, "I'm criticized for teaching everyone the same." And then, you know, well, he was very good in a debate because he's just, he was so intelligent. And, you know, first of all, he just said, that's absolutely ridiculous. But then he did talk, he talks about how the, you know, the personality comes out. There's, how do we say it? The individuality will come out, you know, the, but you know, Welby saying right here, I've got written down, it's, you know, his formula is balance. You control your body. You have to control your body to control your racket, control your racket to control the ball. And when you can control the ball, then we can talk about strategy. But until then, strategy is meaningless. I can remember working in adult camp with Welby and someone raised their hand and said, could you talk to us about strategy? And Welby said, no, no, we can't talk to you about strategy. You have to learn how to hit the ball first. So he was not someone that would sugarcoat it and say, okay, we'll fluff it up and make it presentable. And it was just this, the Welby Van Horn slogan, it was learn tennis, you'll never forget.
Right. That's exactly right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember those days when people would, you know, especially on the adult camps, you'd get adults that were playing in their clubs and they come and they, you know, they've heard about Welby Van Horn and they want to improve their game. And that was often a question asked is, how do I want to learn strategy so that I can beat the people in my club. And so he would get them out on the tennis court and he would say, okay, well, let's see how you hit the ball. And he would hit a couple balls. He would start out usually with a serve and see how they hit the serve. And sometimes you know, you'd see these wild machinations of, you know, flailing arms going all over the place. And he would just lower his head. He would shake his head like that. And he would say, why don't you go sit back down? We're not going to talk about strategy. We're going to talk about the fundamentals because you obviously really need fundamentals. And you're right. He would not sugarcoat it. He was going to tell someone exactly when he saw something, he was going to let them know what he thought. But to the point that, you know, he would make it funny so that, you know, they wanted to come back for more.
Yeah. With Welby and placement, this is rare, where he said, especially during those war years, he said that he thought teaching really helped his play. When you fed for Welby, I mean, you had to feed the ball right on a dime. He wanted you to feed the ball, whether you're doing it just, you know, a fed ball from your racket or a rallied ball, you'd have to put it right in the person's strike zone. And there's a real art to that.
Yes, that is not easy to do, right?
He wanted the ball fed just a certain way. When I went to the camp in Choate, I was still a newcomer. I went 3 years just, you know, observing and studying tennis. And then I was a counselor at a camp, All American Sports, and I was a camp director. So it's interesting, you know, a lot of the counselors are like 18, 19 years old. And I was maybe 5 years older. So, well, they had a training session in the morning and training session in the afternoon. I asked if I could go to both. You had to just go to one. So like, you know, 2-3 hour blocks for like 3 or 4 days. And I was asking questions and I can remember my assignment was they had me team teaching. I remember Betsy saying that we thought you were so nervous, you know, because you're just, you know, you're asking all these questions. You want to go to the training session twice. And, not many people know, but, to this day, Charlie Passerell, timeless. No one has touched what Welby does with beginners. And it's so sad. That's what we're trying to do with our free content is try to carry the torch. The no racket, no ball, hands on your hips. I'll tell you a story with one of our students is very successful, Craig Tiley. He's now the CEO of Tennis Australia. But he at that time was the director of player development for Australia. And in New York, the teachers conference. You know, tennis pros from everywhere go to the US Open, make it a vacation, but there was a 3 or 4 day workshop for tennis teachers, tennis coaches. And you know, I was in the audience, Tyler was giving a presentation and he spent 7 years with, so he certainly knew, even though he never worked for Welby, that most of what he was doing was a Welby Van Horn introduction where hands on your hips, you know, the body balance positions. But Welby, with all his success and so many, you know, the world-class players making comments like an Arthur Ashe, and there's so many of them, there's many testimonials in the book that Ed Weiss wrote that never, Welby never spoke to the USTA, never paid a presentation to the USTA or the USPTA. That just baffles me that that didn't happen.
Yeah, maybe that's attributed more to his sort of thinking in tennis, is that he wasn't someone like a Nick Bollettieri or the others that were more into maybe a little bit more on the commercialization side. So even though it would be a presentation at USTA or USPTA, that's not necessarily commercialization, but it's he had his way and his method and his venues that he liked to be able to teach his method and spread his methodology. And that going in that direction, just maybe the growth of tennis has gone more in the direction of, well, you know, if you're going to be successful as a tennis teacher, you need to get your word out there. Back then, everybody knew about him. So there was really, in his mind, no need to have to go and speak at a conference or something like that. People already knew who he was.
Yeah, no, I think really how it spread was through his players.
Right.
And then and then there was a delay because his players, they were players. They were not, you know, like say Vandermeer was training tennis teachers, where Welby's players became after their careers.
Right. And they all had their different niches, right? You know, Vandermeer was teaching tennis teachers also, and Bollettieri is more of taking the kids who had kind of already had some instruction, some, I guess, basic understanding of tennis.
Yeah, and I think
which was debatable also. But, you know, he was more of a trainer and a motivator.
Oh, for sure. Now that, you know, and Bollettieri knew, you know, Bollettieri certainly knew with everybody knew. But with Welby, the USTA, Scott Schultz, really nice guy. He's retired now. He invited me one time to a meeting up at the USTA with himself and a couple other people, and talking about having a committee for a curriculum. And I said, want to know that, you know, I was just being considered, would I like to be part of the committee? And I said, I don't think we need to do that. You know, tennis in America, you know, there's, you know, people need to know the Welby Van Horn formula. You know, as in say, for example, you know, Braden with science or Vandermeer with progression, and put that together. But that's where it's just really unfortunate with that people don't understand that Welby, he wasn't recruiting students. Somebody who helps us with our podcast, Andres Barbosa, on a podcast, he said 90%, that's his opinion, 90% of tennis is recruiting. Welby, zero. Those players were on, you know, initially four courts. And again, repeat myself, they're just the children of the club members. So the hotel had members. And, you know, you had to be a member of the hotel or a member of the club. So that's just so much the opposite today. I mean, I don't really like the idea where people, I call them third base coaches. I was very honored when Welby said we're cut from the same cloth. Certainly not as a player, but I would never want to be the guy at a tournament, the gal at a tournament that's handing out a business card. You know, your kid's on third base and they're about to score, and I'll coach you. And if we had more first base coaches, like Arthur Ashe said, you know, if you had to take a player from scratch, and, you know, I think Charlie Pasterell says it quite well, is that there's a lot to coaching, you know, the intangibles. When Tim Galloway's book came out, and this is in Ed Weiss's book, and Welby was asked about the inner game, Welby's very articulate, and they ask him, and was a deep thinker, and he said, I teach the outer game. And, you know, you could just see, and, you know, and it's actually, we get that all the time where people can identify our students. And in one sense, it's a compliment that you can identify, you know, and basically our students are a reflection of Welby. But it's actually sad for tennis. You know, when you look across the courts, especially the way it's going now with game-based instruction, you know, instant tennis and all these things where, you know, kids aren't serving and going to the net. You know, they're playing one up, one back doubles. Now, granted, the equipment has something to do with that. The fact that they're ranked at such an early age. You couldn't be ranked at one point. The first time you'd be ranked in the United States, you had to be 13. So many things have changed. But with Passerell saying timeless, you know, I think of Welby, I think of John Wooden, the basketball coach. You know, just also, you know, yeah, sense of humor, but serious. It's like with Bill Walton, his famous player, didn't want to get a haircut. And John Wooden said, well, that's fine, Bill. You have long hair. We're going to miss you around here. You know, you had to get a haircut. But with John Wooden would take these blue chip athletes and say, today, besides, okay, we're going to start teaching you how to put your socks on so you don't get a blister. But today we're going to teach you the chest pass. Today we're going to teach you how to dribble. And they're kind of looking at each other. Hey, we just want a scrimmage coach. But that was Welby.
Yeah, that's exactly right. What you're describing is that there's no shortcut. You know, nowadays, you look at the juniors that are out there that are in their 13, 14-year-olds that even when they step on the court and they're just swinging the tennis racket, the way they swing the racket, you can tell that they've developed a style of game that was a very quick shortcut to becoming a really good tennis player, but probably in the long run, it's not going to be sustainable. And that was what really was Welby's mantra, you know, tennis for a lifetime, is that there's no shortcut to becoming a really good tennis player. And so you have to go through these steps when you're young to learn all those basics that you can then build upon later in life. And if you're taking all those shortcuts, you're going to be missing a lot of things along the way that's going to help you sustain yourself to the future. And that's probably why we still have an issue in U.S. tennis, that you have too many of these students are being taught the shortcuts to get there very, very quickly without really thinking about, okay, what's this going to be, the impact on them in the long run.
Yeah. With Welby, you think he created a train. So the 18s were pulling the 16s. So that's very powerful. But also too, like the comment with Charlie Passerell's mother is respect. Obviously the respect is player, but people respect success and success breeds success. But he did it with the word development. He didn't do it with the word recruiting. There was no backroom deal. And, you know, actually when he got into the tennis boom came along, the tiebreaker, you know, Welby then had to get more into say, group dynamics, but he was basically someone who's just teaching private lessons. And they would go to the backboard, they practice with each other. And he was really big on mini tennis too.
Yes, he was, absolutely. That's, that's timeless, you know, along with the backboard and playing mini tennis. I'm actually surprised. I still play tennis and I play in just recreational leagues with friends. And I'm actually surprised to see that a lot of the people that I play with, they want to start out with mini tennis when they're, just warming up before they go back to the baseline. And it was kind of curious. I'm not sure where that's coming from, but I certainly encourage it because that's a great way to be able to just get your muscles loosened up and to be able to control yourself in a very short, small, tight environment, right? Learning how to be able to control the ball. And that's actually something you can do on a backboard also. My dad used to teach both. You could play long on the backboard for long strokes. You could do overheads. You could do serves. But you could also get your timing and your reaction time if you played, you know, 5-6 feet from the backboard and just repetitively going forehand, backhand, or hitting 10 forehands or 10 backhands and staying at it. I used to do that all the time. I'd play easily on the backboard for an hour, just being close up, get a great workout. But between that and mini tennis, those are absolutely timeless and great techniques to be able to really hone your skills.
I hear my students and I hear they use lines that I use, but those lines are Welby. No plagiarism here. With Welby, here's a great Welbyism. If you try to hit the ball hard, you won't hit the ball right. But if you try to hit the ball right, you'll be able to hit the ball hard.
Yeah.
And it's really too. I mean, just effortless effort. You know, and he'll say things you need to be able to hit on balance and off balance position. So he was very creative too. Okay, we're gonna have you hit your forehand on one foot, you know, the left foot, the right foot. you know, going to the backboard, we do these exercises. Come from Welby is practicing emergency shots. So Welby could hit the overhead, hit down the ball over and over again, hitting overheads against the backboard, but you let it go over your head. Then you got to practice the different type of retrieves you make when the ball's behind you, use a continental grip. I know you have to go to your son's high school graduate or college graduation.
College graduation, yeah.
So those two words, gainfully employed.
Gainfully employed and off the payroll.
There you go. Well, it's great to have you here. With certainly do it again with Welby Van Horn. But he's one of our pillars. And I have to again thank Andre Barbosa. He's the one who said that you should try to do as much as you can to strengthen the pillar so the people behind behind what we are doing with the Great Base curriculum, people know the history and the meaningfulness of it. Let's just talk about this book for 1 second, as well as a closing comment from you. It's Ed Weiss's book. I know we still have to get just a couple things done, but we're going to put it on our website. You want to comment on the book?
Yeah. You know, throughout my dad's career, he had, he's written articles for Tennis, Tennis Week, and he was really good friends with Neil Amder and, you know, other publishers like Gladys and Julius Hellman, and they always really appreciated when he would contribute articles to those. And he would have little, over time, he had little excerpts in other books, but this is the first time that there's actually a book on his method in its entirety. And when Ed Weiss approached him to put this book together, he came with the concept that, you know, you want to find one of the best tennis teachers out there. You know, my dad was absolutely, totally 100% into it. And he spent an enormous amount of time over the course of a couple years with Ed, putting the content together and honing the message and the methodology, making sure that, you know, like we talked about my dad, he had a range of correctness. And over the years, he had developed some flexibility in his teaching method. And I think that's exhibited in the book as well, you know, where his range of correctness had expanded. So it's a great book. It's got a lot of really good content. I definitely recommend it to everybody. Take a look at it. You know, whether you're a beginning tennis player or you're a parent of a tennis player or you're a tennis teacher, there's a lot in there that's definitely worthwhile.
I do think coming back to organizations and making presentations, Welby wasn't one to say, well, I'll be flexible. Oh, we could, you know, change it a little bit. You know, this is the formula. This is what I do. But there were many people, like I think of Eve Kraft, you know, she was in charge of education research for the USTA for a long time. And, you know, I showed you our tennis library. She, I remember we have a book where she dedicates quite a bit of time to Welby. Another book, I think Jim or Cap Layton, but when Ed Weiss,
Jim Layton,
there's Jim and Cap, maybe
Jim Layton wrote a book that
Inside Tennis, right?
Dennis Vandermeer and
your dad,
if I'm getting the right book correct. Yeah. It was Dennis Vandermeer and my father and a couple of other people. It's like a compilation.
Right. Right. But it's, I think Inside Tennis, Inside Techniques. It's certainly a great portion of the book is dedicated to Welby, but this is just all Welby. What happened with Ed Weiss is he's going to be with 8 different tennis teachers, and he just happened to start with Welby first, and he just knew there was enough there. This is a book. And I do think that's with our podcast, we're trying to make it a book, not making it a magazine where we're just interviewing people who are connected to famous players. And I love listening to all the stories because it's the backstories where you really find out, you know, where the character was developed and how people became really good. But why don't you share Welby with us? Welby isn't with him. Or one comment, because I know you can't be late for this graduation party.
A Welbyism. There's so many of them. Well, I will share an expression that was kind of a Welbyism or a mannerism of his. And he always, whenever he was in a, like you said, he was very articulate and very intellectually well positioned to have a really good debate with you on no matter what the topic was. So, you know, when it came to tennis, of course, that was his bread and butter. And one of the things that when he was trying to make a point in a conversation with someone, he kind of did this Spock raise the eyebrow thing. And kind of
Yeah, exactly.
So he was definitely well known for, you know, when he was trying to make a point, and when you're going to come away from that conversation, you better remember that point because he gave you the Welby look, right? So I definitely remember that.
Oh, I remember, you know, being on a court teaching, and he was very quiet in a lot of ways, but he was on the top of the hill at show, and I'm on one of the bottom courts, and just yelled out, "Hey, Steve, you know, this is wrong," and such. But I had a fair amount of experience, and there was a very large tennis camp. Tennis was booming in the 70s. There might have been 40 instructors. And you were given a clipboard, and your name was on the back of the clipboard, and you had to take the clipboard to the court and put it by the net post, and you had to, whether it was attendance or lesson plans, whatever it was. So, you know, Welby didn't learn all 40 names right away, begin the camp. So I remember I'd been there just a short while, and he came by and he took my clipboard and he looked at the back of it. And so then he knew my name, and he said, "Steve, come here for a minute." I'll never forget this. It was fantastic. He said, "You know, one day you might be able to become a tennis teacher," which really he was acknowledging, like, I was a beginner. I think people need to know that you were a beginning tennis teacher. But I certainly, you know, that was a focus. I wanted to become skilled. And that's why I went to spend time with your father. And every day, it's amazing. I have two players here right now, not to mention what academy. Now, I've run academies. I have been hired to go as a consultant to academies, but indirectly, I mean, there's two girls here, teenagers, and they've both been in academies, you know, well-known academies, and, you know, they're teenagers, but they have goals to play competitive tennis. And they really need to go backwards to go forwards. You know, it's okay. We put you through, and we put them through a skills test, hitting targets. We have them play points. We film them. And, you know, that was amazing about Welby, because Braden ended up using, not too many years later, a lot of high speed film, and really on his own, and just that the logical, methodical thinking is without really. I mean, I know that Welby had the film on how to teach tennis, but, you know, he started, I think, in 51 in Puerto Rico. You know, video film didn't really exist back then.
That's right. That's why he was using the mirrors in front of the tennis shop. That was his version of film.
Yeah, out-of-body experience. But when you think about what was produced, again, four courts, just the children of the members, and you're talking Charlie Passerell, all the way to the top is world-class tennis. But anyway, Stuart, thank you very much for coming in and give me the high five. We'll get you off to your party. Wave goodbye to the camera. We'll come back and just follow up with a few comments. Thanks again, Stuart. It was great.
I appreciate it. Thanks for the invitation.
Yeah, it was fun. Okay. Wrapping up our conversation with Stuart Van Horn, Welby's son. From my notes with our podcast number 15 was dedicated to Welby. You go back and listen to Manny Diaz, a student of Welby, now successful, I think 41 years at the University of Georgia. Ed Weiss, who wrote the book, Secrets of a True Tennis Master, was a guest. On our course, Tennis Intelligence Applied, there's many times Welbyisms throughout, like, for example, the Welby Van Horn body balance positions. But clip number 155, I believe there's 365 short videos. One of my students years ago sent me a CD and said, "Oh, Steve, you're going to love this. It's an interview with Welby Van Horn." And there was only one question. "Welby, if you had to name one of your tennis tips as the number one, what would it be?" And it was choking up on the racket for beginners. Because when beginners collapse a wrist on a palm up serve or a wristy forehand, the racket comes back and hits them in the forearm right above the wrist. And on the clip, we take a racket and we just tape, make the butt cap larger and have the bottom part of their hand slightly above the butt cap. Then as the player gets older, their hand is only even with the butt cap. A Welbyism, don't let their hand come off the racket. Players like the hand off the racket. And you'll hear, well, it's a power source. It's not much of a power source. It's really the ground reaction force, the kinetic chain, the leverage hitting away from your body. The young player in that video clip, a very good tennis player, he went out and played at Rice. One thing in my notes is Welby Van Horn's favorite student. I took someone to visit Welby when he was in the extended care in his 90s, extended care nursing home. And mentioned he had a student that was a very good basketball player. He was in his 30s, had a successful professional career. Again, a very good basketball player. And he went through the camp at the beginning of the summer, went home, did everything he was told, came back at the end of the summer, liked it so much, scheduled another session at the camp. And then when he was leaving the camp, he left and headed towards the airport and then headed back. He skipped his flight and he came back and he said, Welby, I have to ask you one question. He goes, how do you keep score? And that's why he was Welby's favorite student. So many people are interested in keeping score right away. Welby played everybody. That's in my notes. Stuart and I touched upon that. I mean, going back to Bill Tilden. Now, Welby gave Bill Tilden perhaps his worst loss, 6-0, 6-2, 6-1. Tilden was much, much older at the time. But he played against Budge, Kramer, Riggs, both Panchos, Pancho Gonzalez, Pancho Seguro. Welby said that Budge was the best player he played against. Tennis world's a small place. Dennis Vandermeer's first wife, Linda, was an excellent tennis player, and she was taught by Welby. One of Welby's students, this is in my notes, touched upon it, Joe Brandy. He coached Pete Sampras 1990 when he won his first major. Joe's daughter, Christina, became a very good player. She was 27 in the world. Joe's younger brother, Andy, was very successful throughout his career, both of them. Andy, a Welby student, won NCAA titles at the University of Florida. His son, Chris, went on to be an All-American. That's really how I got connected to Welby, was through meeting the two Brandys. They both worked at All-American Sports. Manny Diaz, his name came up, University of Georgia, NCAA titles. His sons actually played for him at the University of Georgia. Here's a fun story, Welby. Dan Gold, he was an excellent tennis player. He beat Jimmy Connors at Wimbledon. He won the NCAAs, I think it was 1986, played at Stanford. Jack Shore was his coach. Jack Shore told me this story on the telephone. Because Dan Gold, he said, hey, you need to talk to my coach. I called him up. And when Jack Shore was on vacation in Puerto Rico with his wife, it's as if the vacation stopped there. Add to the story, he said, hey, honey, I'm not going to do anything on the vacation, but sit here and watch this gentleman teach tennis. He just stumbled across Welby and then in spellbound awe, just sat there and watched Welby for the rest of his vacation. And he modeled his tennis teaching after Welby, said he had never seen anything like it. And for those people who have been around a long time, Dan Goldie, if you watch him hit the tennis ball, you can see that he had very efficient strokes. The late Tom Fye. I worked with Tom at the Vic Braden Tennis College. Tom was the tennis director at Indian Wells. And quite often, I'd say every time here recently, because the Easter Bowl has moved to Indian Wells. And there's a picture. I should say there's on the tennis. I've sent many pictures. At Indian Wells, there's a backboard, and it says Welby's Wall. That comes from Charlie Passerell. He's not the owner now, but he's the founder of Indian Wells. So Tommy, he was watching Welby teach. And I remember him saying, I just don't get it. I said, well, you have to watch for a long time. It's going back to how Welby would teach, he would have a player just stand right at the service line, whether they're teaching the volley, the serve, the ground strokes, take them out of the context of the court. And as we talked about, they would not hit tennis balls. It would just be posturing, body balance positions. Welby was like an artist, and he was just a sculptor. He's working with clay. For our students who have been influenced so much by Vic Braden, he didn't do that. he didn't get right next to the student for the most part. He stood on the same side of the net and he would just feather the ball, feed the ball softly. We call it a braid and feed. And he would hit the ball with underspin. So the ball would just sit, like sand for a ground stroke, right in the person's strike zone. But you don't really see hand tossing, static balance, but well, you stand right next to the student, hit, freeze, hit, hold, slow down, self-evaluate. So again, like an artist working with clay. During my chat, my conversation with Stuart, it was Jim Layton, and here's the book. It's interlibrary. You can see it's falling apart a little bit. Inside Tennis, 1977. Inside Tennis, Techniques of Winning. It's by Jim Layton. Jim Layton, there was a stadium named after him at where he coached, Wake Forest, the Wake Forest Tennis Stadium. But as I opened it up, because as I said, the book's falling apart, so as I opened it up, try to put it back together. Well, stroke is a meaningful word to me. You stroke a cat or a dog. You pet the dog. A caressing, slow, like taking a paddle through water. You don't splash water. I remember working with Welby, and he would just ask kids, do you pet your dog like this? And you just do this short chopping motion. Again, so the tennis teaching, it's a science and it's an art, but just how Welby communicated. We had a chance to go through these draw sheets. It's just amazing who Welby played tennis against. This happened with me for going back to just show you Welby Van Horn's respect level he had in Puerto Rico. And in Puerto Rico, the Puerto Rican tennis kids can play in the USTA. And they were looking for a national coach for the first time. And I applied and I was offered the job. I didn't accept the job because there was so much travel. And I, at that time, married with two little kids. I remember Phil Eisenberg put it together. It was a three-way conversation. And Welby Van Horn said, you know, he's the guy. So anyway, hindsight is 20/20. I didn't take the job, but Welby Van Horn and the respect. We need to do a better job letting people know how he taught tennis. And his method should still be honored, respected, honored, understood. I like what Stuart said. There's a narrow band with Welby. I mean, there was precision within his checkpoints. And one thing Stuart said, when we're talking about grips, is with the grip on three on the forehand, it's much easier to play two spins. Now, Jimmy Connors, I've heard people who played against Connors think he had a continental grip on his forehand. He was certainly closer to four, which people consider semi-Western. Jimmy, with a grip on four, he would pull the racket in, and it was amazing how he could return serve flat, which we call a linear pattern, a tabletop pattern. When we were talking about grips with Stuart, and I talked about Welby and watching from the nursing home or in the nursing home with Roger Federer, the championship grip, just so that's clear, reviewing that, the beginner's grip was three. The championship grip was not two, but you brought your hand up close to the top of three. But that's because tennis was different with the wooden rackets and three of the four Grand Slams being played on grass. I think this is something I could have mentioned while Stuart was here. When I met Stuart, I was on Hilton Head Island doing some things with Dennis Vandermeer. And I was hitting some balls with kids that were rotating. Kid hit the ball really well. I didn't know. I just said, hey, kid, what's your name? And he said, Stuart Van Horn. I just caught the last name. And I said, oh, Van Horn. I said, one of the best tennis teachers in the world is named Welby Van Horn. He goes, yeah, it's my father. Here's a few things just to end this with. If you can, the listeners, you get a picture on this for success. Well, Welby was... And he used to say it's a major bonus. You don't have to be a player to be a teacher. And he would stress that. It's a major bonus if you can play. he also talked about Charlie Passerell in his early career, where he became very successful, and that, you know, made people listen to him more, listen better. We brought it up, the backboards, 15 minutes a day. How many times have we told it to the kids? 15 minutes a day is equivalent to an hour of balls hit. Every day, twice a day, shadow swinging in front of a mirror. Matches with his young players being able to play adults. And actually, there should be leagues where, and there were these matches years ago, youth versus veteran. But 10 and under kids would be the benefactor. It would be a major plus if 10-year-olds were playing 55 and 60-year-olds, playing senior citizens, basically. Respect. He had the players' respect. He had the parents' respect. It was almost like a European club when you think about how people were loyal. They knew they could be there from beginning to end. They didn't have to bop and shop. I was in a weight room just today, and a young player came in, and the person who was been on our podcast helping us out, Brandon Flanagan, he put the studio gym, the FM Performance Center together as a young player. Years ago, he took lessons from Brandon and hit the ball extremely well. And he didn't stay the course. That's so important. People start the course, stay the course. Just the story of a player. Not too many players stay working within the fundamental framework that they were taught. Framework. If you're going to build a house, you need framework. You think of Daniel Coyle's book, The Talent Code, and that would have been an example if Welby was alive, or I should say during the time that Daniel Coyle wrote the book, that would have been a great place. As Daniel said in his book, there's only small pockets, and I think that's very true here in the United States, there's only small pockets of where tennis technique is taught and taught and taught well. So an environment from the parents to the players to the coaches to get it. Once you see it, you can't unsee it. This is going back and repeating myself, but just a very good way to say it. Parents weren't thinking we need to go somewhere else. You know, the grass is not greener on the other side of the fence. So really, there was a championship culture, a learning environment. But again, thank you, Stuart, for being part of the podcast. Our goal, I think there's different ways to say that. Our goal is to help you with your goal. Certainly one goal, and we say it all the time, is to carry the torch of tennis teachers from the past. I think a good way to sum this up is balance. You have to control your body. If you can control your body, then and only then you can control your racket. If you control your racket, then and only then you can control the ball. And if you control the ball, then you, and Welby, then you can intelligently play tennis. Welby, 95% of people play at tennis, 5% of people play tennis. And live and let live. If people are hitting and giggling and hacking away, no problem. But if someone wants to play serious tennis, Welby Van Horn, learn tennis you'll never forget. Okay, thanks again, listeners. I hope you got something out of this podcast. We always say golden nuggets for your tennis treasure chest. Adios, amigos.